Okay, so superstrings.
Superstrings. If we have approximate supersymmetry, that is, symmetry between fermions and bosons, then that opens the way toward dealing with a mathematical theory called superstring theory, which may be a big step toward the long-desired unified theory of all the particles and all the forces. Or maybe not. I have the suspicion that it will be an important step on that road. And the reason is that superstring theory manages to harmonize quantum mechanics and Einstein's general relativistic theory of gravitation. And it does so without encountering any of the crazy infinities that plague the usual attempts to do that. That's the triumph of superstring theory, and therefore maybe there's something in it. Maybe it is an important step on the road toward the hoped-for unified theory. The theory itself involves some rather special ideas. The number of dimensions of space does not come out to be three, the number that we observe around us.
Well, that our small minds can use to do dealing with.
But it comes out to be 10 or sometimes 11 total dimensions, which means 9 or 10 spatial dimensions and one time dimension. So 9 or 10 spatial dimensions and one time dimension. However, theorists have cleverly thought up the idea that maybe those additional dimensions are very small. They're wrapped up in little packets, little packages that are very small. Maybe 10 to the minus 33rd centimeters across or something like that. In which case we wouldn't encounter them in our observations as spatial dimensions. But they might have an effect, indirect effect on what we observe. Anyway, there's a lot of controversy about the superstring theory. Should it be pursued very assiduously, with lots of people working on it and lots of resources available for thinking about it and so on? Or is it just a passing fancy? And as I indicated, I think it's likely to be important.
One of the books that I've noticed recently that seem to be popular books, one of them is called The Age of Entanglement. This is by Louisa Gilder, and is basically bringing up to date work that I suppose goes back to Einstein, Podolsky, Rosen. And then comes through John Stuart Bell's work, David Bohm, non-locality issues, and so on. Do you follow that stuff?
Certainly do, and there's an awful lot of nonsense in it. Lots of things that people say are just silly. I don't know about the work you mentioned. I can't comment on it because I've never seen it. But some of what some people say is pretty silly.
Well, let's take the
example. The thought experiment that Einstein and his young collaborators discussed in the 1930s is not the easiest thing to carry out, actually. But there's an almost equivalent experiment that has been carried out that we can discuss. You have a neutral meson at rest, decaying, disintegrating into two photons, which come off in opposite directions with equal and opposite momenta. the same energy, of course. And you imagine that one of them is somehow detected, not necessarily by a person. Despite what they say in most of the literature, it's not necessary to have a physicist and a piece of apparatus around. But something is recording this photon, one of them. Now, if that something records the circular polarization of that photon, then because of the entanglement of the two photons, they both come from that disintegration of that meson, because of that entanglement, because of their because their past histories are involved with each other, when the circular polarization of one of them is determined, the circular polarization of the other one is determined. Well, that could happen classically also. What's peculiar about quantum mechanics is that you can discuss also the possibility that the linear polarization of the photon is determined, in which case the linear polarization of the other photon is determined as well, immediately, because they're connected by this common origin in the disintegration of that meson.
Now, when you say immediately,
immediately,
you mean with zero time passing.
Exactly. Exactly.
Which?
Exactly. But there's no signal propagated. That's right. But there's no signal propagated from one to the other. Nothing is happening. It's just that the two things are related to each other, and therefore when one is determined, the other is determined. What's peculiar about quantum mechanics is that this could be true either of the linear polarization or of the circular polarization. However, if you present quantum mechanics correctly, not the way people usually talk about it, but you present it correctly in terms of histories, then what quantum mechanics does is to predict the probabilities of alternative, coarse-grained histories of the universe. Alternative, coarse-grained, decoherent histories, that is, they don't have interference terms between them. Then on one branch of history, the linear polarization is determined. On another branch of history, the circular polarizations are determined of the two photons. There is no branch of history on which they are both determined. Now that's the point that lies at the root of Einstein's work in the 1930s with those younger collaborators. What he said was that a theory was, as he called it, complete, which meant satisfactory to him, Einstein, if it obeyed the following rule, that if a certain property, A, can be measured exactly, and another property, B, can be measured exactly, then they can both be measured exactly. Well, he was ruling out quantum mechanics with that. It's not necessary to go through the rest of the paper. It's not necessary to discuss the thought experiment in detail. It's not necessary to go up to the more modern experiment, which was actually carried out with the two photons. It's not necessary to say anything. Einstein was ruling out quantum mechanics by fiat, because when two operators don't commute, you can't determine them both exactly at the same time.
I've got about three places I want to go with this, and you choose.
That's quantum mechanics.
Right.
He was ruling out quantum mechanics right there with that sentence. And then, of course, the rest of it followed. Somehow that seems to escape many people. I don't understand why, but it does. Then they say that the property that we were discussing of quantum mechanics is called non-locality. Well, they name it non-locality, but it is not non-locality. They just call it that. The correct thing to say is that if such phenomena were to be interpreted classically, then you would need either non-locality or negative probabilities or both. But they're not classical. It's only in quantum mechanics that this happens, that you could have either the linear or the circular polarization determined, and then the other one is determined.
Could you just gloss that a little bit, the linear and circular polarizations for a...
Mean what it means?
Yeah.
Well, light is, of course, composed of electromagnetic waves. And in quantum mechanics, these electromagnetic waves can be quantized as photons, which are packets of electromagnetic energy. The photon is the carrier of the electromagnetic force. The electrical vibrations in these waves are perpendicular to the direction of motion of the light quantum or photon. And so let's say it's the z direction in which the photon is going, then it could be linearly polarized in the x direction or in the y direction. Or it can be circularly polarized, right-handed or left-handed. Those operations don't, as we say, commute, and those things can't be measured exactly simultaneously, as is famous for the position and momentum of a particle. They can't be measured exactly simultaneously. If they are measured simultaneously, you have the uncertainty principle. There's a similar situation, not exactly the same, but a similar situation for the linear and the circular polarization. And for that reason, Einstein's requirement for what he called completeness, that if you could measure property A for sure and you can measure property B for sure, then you should be able to measure A and B for sure. It just rules out quantum mechanics right away, because this is not true in quantum mechanics.
When you used the phrase about their histories are entangled.
Yes. The two photons come from the disintegration of a meson. They have this common origin. And what that does is to create a correlation between them. So that if this linear polarization of one is determined, the linear polarization of the other one is determined. And if the circular polarization of one of them is determined, the circular polarization of the other one is determined. But nothing happens. There isn't a signal transmitted from one place to the other. That's forbidden by relativity theory, as everybody knows. You can't have signals transmitted faster than the speed of light, and you don't. So there is nothing going on. There is no spooky action at a distance, as Einstein called it. There isn't such a thing. There isn't any signal propagated from one to the other. It's just that these photons have a common origin, and therefore their polarizations are entangled. It's so simple.
So what is the...
Quantum mechanics is not weird, it's just quantum mechanics.
I thought Feynman said that it was, if anybody thought they ever understood it, then they were deluding themselves.
If Feynman said that, he was merely quoting Bohr. Bohr said, if somebody can, well, roughly he said, I'm trying to translate from the Danish, if somebody thinks that he can understand quantum physics, that just shows that he knows nothing about it. Something like that. Well, I don't think that's true. I think you can understand quantum mechanics perfectly well if you don't use the usual stupid language. The main thing is to recognize that these two alternative measurements of or determinations, or whatever you want to call it, recordings, of the polarizations of these photons, that these things are on different branches of history. That's the important thing. If you use that language, you won't go wrong.
So what does this word non-locality mean then?
Oh, it's supposed to mean that interactions are not local, that they can occur over distance. That's not true. There is no non-locality. There's no non-locality in nature that we know of. Now, somebody may discover non-locality sometime in the future, but at the moment we don't know of anything that's genuinely non-local. But what some of these quantum theorists using unfortunate language, have called non-locality, what they've labeled non-locality, is not, in fact, non-locality. I told you what it is. This situation that we described with the two photons is a situation which, if it were classical, would require either genuine non-locality or else negative probabilities. And that's what Bell showed.
Did you ever meet Bell?
I knew Bell. We were very friendly. We talked. He was very bright. He didn't, so far as I know, did he do anything wrong. But he did distrust quantum mechanics. And he hoped that it would be replaced by something else. Or at least I think he did. I think he hoped that it would be replaced by something different. Whereas I find quantum mechanics perfectly satisfactory, and I don't know of anything wrong with it, and we don't know of any place in which it fails. In dealing with quantized gravitation, it is probably necessary to generalize quantum mechanics a teeny little bit, as my colleague Jim Hartle has shown in a very beautiful article. And if you do that slight generalization of quantum mechanics, using the method that Dick Feynman developed after studying Dirac's quantum mechanics book, his sum over histories method in quantum mechanics. If you use that, and you can generalize quantum mechanics a tiny little bit using it, then all the problems with the real conceptual problems with quantum gravitation are dealt with, as Jim Hartle showed. But let me tell you the story about David Bohm, if you're interested in David Bohm.
All right.
Okay. 1951, I was a postdoc at the Institute for Advanced Study in Princeton.
And Einstein would have been there.
Einstein was certainly there.
So did you ever have a chance to, before you tell this story, to actually talk to Einstein and discuss?
I had chances, no doubt, but I never did it. I didn't want to be the kind of young person who associated himself with famous figures from the past, so that he could say at dinner, I was talking with Einstein today, and I just didn't want to be that kind of kid. And so I didn't approach Einstein and set up an appointment with him to talk about the old days or something. Today I probably would. Yeah. But at that time I just didn't want to be that sort of person. But I used to see him almost every day, coming to work.
This was 1951.
Yes.
So you had been at Yale originally.
I was at Yale as an undergraduate.
When you were 15.
And MIT, yes. MIT as a graduate student. And now I was at the Institute for Advanced Study in Princeton. I was just 21.
Right.
And I was a bachelor, and was just loose ends in the evenings often. And David Bohm was an assistant professor at Princeton University. And in some trouble with the witch hunters of that time, the Committee on Un-American Activities and that sort of thing. And he looked sort of like a witch because he was a Marxist and who knows whether during the war he might have been some kind of spy or something. I don't know of any evidence of that, but naturally in those days that was the sort of thing people thought. In any case, he was interrogated by some committee, and finally Princeton didn't renew his contract because of that. He actually left the U.S. and didn't come back to live in the U.S. permanently. He had jobs in Brazil, in Israel, in Great Britain, and so on. But he was basically in exile for most of his life. Although after a certain number of years, when all these things died down, he was able to visit the U.S. In any case, he was then in Princeton, and he was also unattached. He had lost his partner. And so the two of us wandered around Princeton sometimes in the evening, just talking, discussing all sorts of things. And he told me about his Marxist views and how they seemed to be at variance with quantum mechanics, because how do you explain quantum mechanics to the peasants, and so on. And this lack of determinism seemed to contradict Marxist ideas, but he persuaded himself that quantum mechanics was correct and that there was no necessary collision with his philosophical views. And then he wrote a book on quantum theory in which he mentioned very prominently these ideas of his about the so-called measurement process, which is the way people conventionally describe the kind of thing we were just talking about. So he had written a book in which these issues figure prominently. The book was not yet published.
Right, but in brief, his take on this would be...
that quantum mechanics was correct, that there was no contradiction to his Marxist principles, and he was going to explain how it worked, and so on. So he, that way he overcame his doubts about quantum mechanics by writing the book. And the book was about to come out. And on one of these evenings, he said, "Murray, can you get me an appointment with Einstein? Because you're at the Institute for Advanced Study, and so is he. And I want to discuss these my book with Einstein." And I want to see what he thinks of my arguments. Maybe we can reach a common point of view on quantum mechanics. I said, "Well, I don't have much influence in that corner, but I'll talk with his formidable secretary, Helen Dukas, and see if I can get you an appointment." But I couldn't do it for a day or two. And then 2 days later, I met him, and I said, "I'm working on your appointment with Einstein, but I haven't got it yet." He said, "Don't bother, don't bother. You know what happened? My book was published 2 days ago. Einstein immediately got a copy and read it and phoned me." So I said, "Well, what happened?" He said, "Well, we made an appointment. We're going to talk tomorrow." So 2 days later, I met him again, and I was eager to find out what happened. "David, what happened?" He looked very sheepish, and he said, "He talked me out of it." And David spent the rest of his life on some futile effort to rewrite quantum mechanics. Not quantum mechanics in general, but just one particle, non-relativistic quantum mechanics, the simplest possible version of it, to rewrite it in some very ugly form, a complicated form, so that he could describe it in some new language. It was not probabilistic anymore, it was deterministic, but there were certain things that you couldn't know, and therefore, effectively, it was probabilistic. I don't see what the difference is. To me, it's a distinction without a difference.
The connection between physics and philosophy and even mysticism is quite strong, as you know.
Not for me.
Well, but the time I remember...
For my joke about the Eightfold Way, I named an approximate symmetry scheme for the strongly interacting elementary particles the Eightfold Way as a joke. Because eights kept coming up. The number eight kept coming up in the scheme. And there were some people who thought that it was somehow connected with Oriental mysticism and wrote books about that. They didn't realize it was a joke, I guess.
A lot of your nomenclature still exists, right? I mean, quarks is your coinage, right?
Yes, right.
So the time I sat down and talked with David Bohm was in Ojai, in California.
Oh, yes.
And he was visiting, as he often did, the...
with some Indian mystic.
Krishnamurti.
Oh, yes.
And...
The image of Krishna.
So...
Krishnamurti.
So there's obviously people that sometimes make these kind of connections about... And you can see why this notion of oneness, at one with the universe, a kind of a Spinozistic view.
Spare me.
So, but what do you say to somebody like Andre Lind? I talked to Andre Lind and I asked him who was his favorite philosopher, and he would say it was Spinoza, and there'd be...
Oh, well, Spinoza was an interesting fellow. At least he was not much of a theist, and that's always a good thing.
Why do you say spare me, though? I mean, is that...
No, I don't mind about Spinoza. But all this other stuff is not my cup of tea. Mm. Spinoza claimed to be religious in a certain sense, but it was a very mild sort of religion. And not really very strongly theistic.
Do you get into the
And his ethics was derived from a sort of logical analysis.
Right, but if you, as you know, if you ask...
He proved theorems about what would be ethical and what would not be ethical based on certain general principles of human conduct and so on. He didn't derive it from tablets recording what some divinity had revealed.
No, that kind of analysis was done by Newton, who worked on biblical sources as well, as you know. But if you asked Einstein is well known for having said that he believed in Spinoza. If you asked him about belief, he would talk about Spinoza's God, one who saw harmony in the universe and so on and so forth. Those phrases. As you have become a public figure and had to deal with the way in which science is communicated,
yes,
in this country and so on, do you ever find yourself in this issue about science and religion? Do you have any religious views?
I have no religious views. Well, I have a view that I don't agree with religion.
So you wouldn't give the same answer that Einstein did, for example?
Yes, I could, I suppose. It's easier, to say I'm an atheist, I suppose, than to say that I believe in the God of Spinoza. There's not much difference.
Right.
In my view. Yeah. And other people's views, probably a lot of difference, but not mine.
So, going back to the whole notion of entanglement, because as I said, I seem to see some sort of resurgence of interest in those issues. You think that this is a false trail that people
which are, is a false trail.
Going back to issues about non-locality and...
No, it's all fine, but I described it correctly, and most people describe it in a very confused manner. That's all. They don't recognize that these two things, the determination of the linear polarization and the determination of the circular polarization, for example, have to occur on different branches of history. They don't occur on the same branch. Just as the exact measurement of the position of something and the exact measurement of its momentum can't occur on the same branch at the same time.
I mentioned to you earlier, this is a bit of a leap, but yes. I think you may allow it. The paper that I've been reading of yours recently was a paper that you gave at an SFI workshop in Honolulu, and deals with the notion of human histories as well.
What I talk about is the exploitation and description and study of regularities in human history,
right,
which has become a very important subject. People have made, I think, very interesting strides, and not always within the discipline of history. So some of the things I describe fall more into category of anthropology rather than but they are related, nevertheless, to human history and prehistory.
When we did the public television series that we collaborated on, we involved you in some years ago.
Many decades ago, many centuries ago.
Not quite that long ago. No. But you were in Chaco Canyon, right? We had you in Chaco Canyon.
Yes, with George Gummerman.
Right.
And I was just in Chaco Canyon again last week.
Right, and you have this interest in those civilizations.
Oh, right? Very much so, yes.
What's your sense at the moment of what we learn from those kind of civilizations? I'm thinking now about complexity issues, about the vanishing of societies, the building up of complex human societies, and then they go away again, and so on. The whole
yes. Well, archaeologists and other anthropologists have a particular meaning for complexity, what they call social complexity. And it fits in with my definition of complexity perfectly well when it's applied to a certain set of things, namely human social organization, social roles for human beings in a certain society. So, for example, now, very crudely speaking, my idea of complexity, which I think captures what it means in most conversation and even in a lot of scientific discourse, complexity means if something is complex, it means that it takes it requires a long description to talk about its regularities. The features that are treated as random or incidental, I don't include. I just include the features that are treated as regular, as regularities, in distinct contradistinction to the features that are treated as random or unimportant. So you apply your coarse graining to the situation. And what anthropologists, including archaeologists, do is to apply a coarse graining in which they are talking mainly about social roles. So if there is a lot of specialization in the society, so that there are people who make pottery and there are other people who make jewelry and there are other people who erect buildings and there are other people who carry the timbers for the roofs of the buildings and there are other people who do other things and so on and so forth. There are a lot of different ways to be a person in that society. Similarly, there may be a tribal council, or there may be a leader or chief, or there may be a set of religious societies, or there may be a clan structure, and there may be somebody who is the chief of the clan, and so on and so forth. So the more of these complex, the more of these roles there are, the longer it takes to describe the social roles, the social organization, and therefore the more complex. So this social complexity is what they are talking about. You can also look at the productions themselves. You can look at the pottery and how long it would take to describe the regularities of the pottery, how long it would take to describe the regularities of the masonry and the construction of the villages, and so on and so on and so forth. So what's interesting about the American Southwest, and many other places as well, is the pattern of increasing complexity and then abandonment. And then again, increasing complexity, sometimes in other places. And then again, abandonment, and so on and so forth. And one can distinguish in the Southwest at least three relatively recent waves of abandonment. And what's interesting, the most interesting about them to me, is that in each case, the areas that were abandoned or the areas where the archaeological material changed dramatically, that they are contiguous. So around the year 1130, there was a wave of abandonment, including several noted cultures. And then another one in the end of the 13th century, when there was a long drought lasting most of the last 30 years of the 13th century. So it's a wave of abandonment in the late 1200s and around 1300. And of course, the people didn't all die. They moved elsewhere in general. And sometimes you can make good guesses from archaeological material as to where they may have gone, which societies might have absorbed them. But it's fascinating how there were these three. I mentioned one in 1130, another one in the run-up to 1300, and the third one sometime in the 15th century, maybe 1450, 1430, so on. The one at the end of the 1200s seems to have been materially influenced by a big drought lasting almost 30 years at the end of the 13th century. The one in the 15th century is less studied and less understood than the other two, even though it's more recent. You would think it would be the best understood, but it's not. There is still the possibility, although many archaeologists argue strongly against it, there's still the possibility that the Athabascans, the Apache, including the Navajo, moved in at that time and played a role in the abandonments by Pueblo people of certain areas, especially since we often find Athabascans living now in those places. But as I said, and many archaeologists argue that the advent of the Athabascans was later.
I was wondering if this interest in growth and collapse of civilization, yes. cyclicities, yes. and so on, yes. if such there be,
yes.
means that you have an interest in the current issues about sustainability and so on and so forth.
Oh, you? Well, I've been interested in sustainability for a very, very, very long time. And as you probably know, when I was one of the directors of the MacArthur Foundation, yes. I was a director for 23 years until term limits finally caught up with me. I played a role in setting up the programs on biodiversity conservation and many other environmental issues at the MacArthur Foundation. And in particular, I argued strongly for the founding of the World Resources Institute, along with the man who became the first president of the World Resources Institute, Gus Speth. Gus Speth went on after that to be the head of the UN Development Program, and then until right now, he has been for 10 years, the dean of the School of Forestry and Environmental Studies at Yale. He's also a Yale graduate like me. He is now retired, but teaching at the Vermont Law School and living in Vermont. Anyway, Gus and I managed to influence strongly the founding of the World Resources Institute, which is devoted to global environmental problems. And focuses in part on sustainability. I also organized a project on paths toward a possible sustainable society in the future. It was called Project 2050, and I describe it in The Quark and the Jaguar. Mm-hmm. It was not a great success because we didn't collect enough money for it. The MacArthur Foundation itself actually put in $3 million, which was very generous, but not enough. But it was assumed that the other big foundations would contribute too. MacArthur usually kicked in when another big foundation had a project that required cooperation of many. But the others didn't follow suit. They didn't think the MacArthur Foundation was worthy of having its project funding matched. And so we didn't get any more money. We had only the $3 million. And it just wasn't enough. We had figured that 8 was an irreducible minimum, and we would have preferred more than that. As a result, fruit of this effort was not so, this effort was not so fruitful.
Well, are you optimistic or pessimistic about the way the trends are going at this point?
I mean, well, lots of people are now interested in sustainability, and maybe one could revive something like that project. The special feature of that project was that it was supposed to study everything. When you're faced with a very complex set of issues, it's natural to break the whole problematique up into many different parts. So with the world problematique, you would separate off military and diplomatic issues, political issues in each area, social issues, economic questions, technological advances, environmental effects, demographic effects, and so on, and so, ideological effects, and so on and so forth, all of these different departments. So you might study two or three of them at a time. But normally you would not try to look at all of them. The problem is that if you study the world problematique from each of these points of view and then put all those studies together, you don't get a picture of the whole thing. That's what happens when you have a complex nonlinear system. You can't study the various parts or aspects determined in advance and expect them to fit together to make a description of the whole thing. In that sense, the whole is more than the sum of its parts. The famous and mysterious saying. But it's true here. And so what I have always favored is to supplement the partial studies, which are very important and need to be done always, to supplement them with some work on the whole thing. Now, naturally, that can't be done very well. To look at everything is just very difficult and very expensive and time-consuming. But what you can do is to look crudely at the whole thing. I call it a crude look at the whole, C-L-A-W, claw. And this claw approach I advocate, not as a replacement for the usual studies, but as a supplement.
This would be equivalent to your coarse graining issue.
Well, it's somewhat similar to what we did in starting the Santa Fe Institute.
Yeah.
There we're talking not about different aspects of the world future and about policy studies. We were talking there about scientific efforts, efforts in theoretical science. And there again, we thought that the usual highly specialized work should be supplemented by interdisciplinary or transdisciplinary research. Now we're applying the same kind of idea to a completely different domain, not pure scientific research, but policy studies. That in policy studies, one should also supplement the individual studies of particular areas, like economics, technology, and environment, or demography and health, and so on and so on. But rather, to take a look at the whole thing as a supplement to the specialized studies.
What, in your view, should be the relationship between policy implementation bodies, governments, and so on and so forth, and the scientific community? If the president is talking about restoring science to its rightful place, what is its rightful place?
Well, the president surely was thinking, at least in part, of scientific advice to government bodies and government officials, including himself, and that he wanted that advice to be to come from highly qualified scientists, some of them sometimes organized into committees and commissions and other groups. And I'm sure that he was thinking particularly that advice should not be muddied by political interference with the documents concerned. If a scientific group prepares a report on something for the president, it should come to the president as they prepared it, not with a lot of lines crossed out by some third-rate political appointee.
You were involved in this advice process at one point. There were
2 points.
You were adjacent, though, weren't you? Which was
3 points.
Ah, okay.
I was one of the founders of JASEN.
Which is the, perhaps you should.
JASEN was a group of scientists, at the beginning mostly physicists, but later many different kinds of scientists, who advised the Department of Defense on a variety of issues. And I remain a member, actually, after, how long is it now? 40 years. Approximately. But I haven't been to the meetings in decades. I drifted apart from Jason. But anyway, I did have that experience for a few years. Then I was on the President's Science Advisory Committee when Nixon was president. And then I was on the President's Council of Advisors on Science and Technology, a corresponding body, when Bill Clinton was president. As you can imagine, it was more fun being on the committee with Clinton than it was with Nixon.
I was going to say, they must have been slightly different experiences.
Yes, they were very different. And by the way, when I speak of Clinton, it was really Clinton and Gore.
Right.
Because Al Gore was always there and played a very big role. And it was so interesting with Clinton and Gore, because if you were on a panel, a committee of the, a subcommittee of the PCAS, the President's Council of Advisors on Science and Technology, you would participate in writing a report which went to the president. Well, in the case of Clinton and Gore, it would come back with numerous interlinear comments and questions and so on by both the president and the vice president. And we would then meet, sometimes with the president, more often with the vice president, and go over all of these comments and questions and so on, and thrash them out. They were both deeply interested and understood very well what the documents were about, mm-hmm. and what the implications were, and what their political concerns would be in connection with these various proposals. It was very good. Unfortunately, after the first 2 years, Congress was in the hands of the other party, and they couldn't do much. They tried to follow our advice in many, many cases and couldn't.
Just following up on that point, you mentioned Gore, for example. I'm thinking now, obviously, about the global warming stuff, Gore's film, and so on and so forth, and the enormous furore that continues with so many people that I meet. At scientific meetings and at meetings where one is also have members of the public present,
yes.
as well. That there is still an enormous amount of disbelief, as far as I can see, in what is generally held...
In anthropogenic...
The generally held...
Global climate scientific, change.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, it's hard for many people to understand. I don't know why it should be hard for scientists to understand, but for the general public, it's easy to see how they could be... how they could have trouble. Because climate change, for example... change of average temperature with time, which is a very crude measure, but it's one that people keep talking about. Such things are... any such mathematical quantity is a sum of various terms. There are cyclical effects with different periods. There are effects that have to be described as random. Noise. And then there's one could call a secular term, slowly but steadily rising term coming from anthropogenic effects, the human-caused climate change. And what you see is the sum. You don't see these individual parts. You see the sum. So in a given year, it could go in the wrong direction. For example, if there's eruption of a big volcano, there's a lot of ash in the air, cuts out sunlight, you have a decrease in temperature. As in 1816, when we had the year without a summer after an eruption in Indonesia. The eruption of Krakatoa did something similar. And recently, the Pinatubo event led to a cooling episode.
Even Mount St. Helens some years ago.
Yes, also gave a certain amount. So it's a sum of several terms. And, but if you wait until the secular term, the steadily rising term coming from human effects, gets so large that it completely dominates the noise and the cyclical terms. It's too late to do anything. So we had better take out an insurance policy now, not wait. That's the most conservative view, it seems to me, of the issue.
So I would argue, in fact, that there's a general misunderstanding of how science is done, what science is capable of doing, that there's a sense that it should supply certitude. In fact, it doesn't do that. It's a moving target and so on.
Yes.
We've had this conversation. How does one convey more effectively?
Well, I think that although Bill Moyers thought it was ridiculous to try to explain it to the public this way, I remember, I don't think it's so bad. I think think in terms of insurance is the best way. We and our allies, the United States and allies, spent trillions of dollars on what was basically an insurance policy against a rather improbable event, a Soviet invasion of Western Europe and associated other activities. People didn't complain so much about that. They knew that it was not 100%, that it was not, it was very far from 100% certain. In fact, it was, I think, an improbable event. Nevertheless, it was probably worth paying an enormous sum to insure against it. And here we have a highly probable event, the consequences of anthropogenic climate change. Huge numbers of scientists warning about it. And surely we should take out a large amount of insurance against that and do it promptly when it would still do some good. Most of these changes involving alternative sources of energy and so on are good things in themselves. Most of them are wonderful things to do completely independent of global climate change. Mm-hmm. So let's go for it.
What's to lose?
Pardon? Yes, in a certain sense, yes. Yeah. And as my friend Amory Lovins keeps pointing out, the so-called economic costs may, in a number of instances, turn out actually to be negative. They may be profits.
Amory runs the Rocky Mountain Institute,
yes.
Right?
Yeah. The Rocky Mountain Institute specializes in giving advice to private business on improvements in sustainability, especially saving energy. And of course, saving energy saves money. And they're able to find initiatives that are that improve sustainability. And then make a profit. They're not always costs.
Again, on this sense of public understanding of science, you mentioned the word energy. For some reason, I flashed on Boltzmann. I had a conversation the other day with Harold Marowitz.
Oh, yes.
And Harold was telling us about going to Vienna.
He explained that we were lab partners 64 years ago.
He did not. No.
That's when I first met him.
Where was that?
Yale.
At Yale. Wow.
Sophomore physics lab.
He was talking about, obviously, this entropy is a hugely important topic. S equals K log W, Boltzmann's constant, so on and so forth. This was precisely the...
It's at Boltzmann's grave.
He was at Boltzmann's grave. Yes,
no, but I mean, that's where you have S equals K log W.
He was looking for it, and he was telling us that, in fact, the graves were separated out into sections by profession. So there was a grave section for musicians, a grave section for scientists, and so on. But
and I hope they put Boltzmann in the right place.
Right. This was the example that Snow used, as you recall, in his Two Cultures lecture, of being whether somebody was cultured or you know, that one should just as well know Boltzmann's laws as one should know passages of Shakespeare, or something equivalent to that.
Well, what's interesting about that divide is that you will occasionally find a scientist in an English-speaking country. Oh, sorry.
It's for you.
Now, what were we talking about? I haven't the vaguest idea what we were talking about. Something about painting a house?
No, Boltzmann and snow.
Oh,
and
snow, two, yes, snow. Cultures. I am not such a great admirer of C.P. Snow, although I never didn't know him very well. I met him briefly for a few minutes on a couple of occasions. He was an excellent storyteller. He really knew how to tell a story. But as to what was in the story and what was in his various comments and so on, while they are, you know, generally to the point, I don't find them extremely brilliant.
Do you think this notion of, I mean, Chris Mooney and Shale Kirschenbaum, yeah, as we, yes, discussed earlier, have a book out which sort of commemorates that and yeah, is titled Unscientific America. Do you think there's too much hand-wringing on going on about this?
Well, let's go back to the two vultures.
You did say the two vultures.
Yeah. Well, there was a play by that name, Caltech. An English professor at Caltech wrote a play called The Two Vultures, referring to Snow. Anyway, it's perfectly true that while you will occasionally find a scientist in an English-speaking country who's unfamiliar with Shakespeare's plays, you'll never find, I think, such a scientist who is proud of being unacquainted with Shakespeare's plays. Most likely he would feel a little sheepish about it and wish that he knew them better or wish that he knew them at all. But it's very common to find people on the arts and humanities side who are really proud of knowing nothing about mathematics and nothing about science, especially physical science. That's a little odd. And that's something worth remedying, I think. Science is a very important part of human culture. And to separate it off as something distinct from human culture is weird. Very strange.
So the remedy would be what?
Oh, to, you know, reach somehow a situation in which, just as it's natural to expect people to be familiar with certain things in music and literature and history and so on, you expect them to be familiar with the most important aspects of science as well.
This is a tricky question, but you mentioned Snow. This must be one of just an enormous parade of interesting people that you've met over a distinguished life. Who are the most, would you care to name the most memorable people that you met? Who was the most interesting people that you had conversations with, do you think?
Oh, I don't know. That would be very hard to say. But there were two people who regularly finished my sentences for me.
Oh, they were brave.
Yes. No, I mean, correctly. Correctly.
Who would that be?
One of them was Robert Oppenheimer, and the other one was Bill Clinton.
That's an interesting, odd couple. Oppenheimer, look, we're not very far from Los Alamos, of course. So
that's right.
From Trinity Site, so we are in the...
Trinity Site is not nearby. Trinity
that's
Site.
New Mexico, Alamogordo, right?
Yes, right.
So, what was Oppenheimer like?
Well, we were very friendly. I liked him a lot. But he occasionally had bitchy moments and they got him into terrible trouble. He never did that with me, but sometimes happened. He was very, very bright. Well informed about a lot of things. He didn't usually take the time, when he was doing science, to go very deeply into issues that he discussed. But the things he did do with various, usually with a collaborator, so different collaborator for each problem, the things he did write were little gems, very interesting, original work on new problems. Very early work on neutron stars, predicting neutron stars, so-called. I would prefer to call them something else, but never mind. very early work on black holes. Number of other things, number of other issues.
That was a John Wheeler sort of coinage, wasn't it? Black hole.
Oh, God, yes. Yes, John Wheeler. A number of things like that.
Your favorite, physicist that you most looked forward to having a conversation with, let me put it that way then. Because you would find something new or inspiring.
Well, for years that was true of my neighbor, Richard Feynman. We had offices basically next door to each other for 33 years. And for the first few years, I really, really looked forward every day when we were both there, to conversations with him. But after a while, I lost my enthusiasm for conversing with him. I still did sometimes. We did, exchange ideas. Right up to the very end, right up until his death. But it wasn't the same. He was so fixated on himself, it was just difficult to be a collaborator.
Isn't that difficult, though, if you have people who are the collaboration requires a very different personality from being sort of a sui generis inventor, as it were, and theoretician, I would have thought.
Yeah. Well, anyway.
Did you ever meet Dirac?
Oh, yes. I talked with Dirac on a number of occasions. I enjoyed it immensely. He was so he was so pithy. I asked him about how back in the 1920s, as you would go from 1923 to 1924, and you look at his papers, you see that he was fussing with the old quantum theory, and then all of a sudden, he's doing quantum mechanics, 1924. And I said, what was that transition like? And he said, oh, I read Heisenberg's paper. Then I asked him something else. I said, Paul Adrian, lectures that I've been giving, this was in 1966 in Cambridge, the real Cambridge. These lectures that I've been giving, mostly on quarks. And most of our colleagues don't believe in quarks. But from the questions you asked, I gather that you do. What is it you like about the quarks? And he said, oh, they do have spin 1/2, don't they? Meaning they obey the Dirac equation with only small corrections, unlike, say, the neutron and proton, which have magnetic moments that deviate hugely from the Dirac values. The quarks don't. But the way he said it was just, they do have spin 1/2, don't they?
There's a painting we were just talking about up on the wall there by Diego Rivera, or at least a copy of, I'm not sure.
Oh, it must be a copy, come on.
You'd think.
Otherwise we'd have an armed guard in here.
It's called El Matemático. And we were just saying that it looks familiar, and you thought, is that Gödel, perhaps?
I don't know who it would be.
But so Gödel was at
The Institute for Advanced Study, and he and Einstein would come to work together when Gödel wasn't institutionalized or otherwise unavailable, and when Einstein was okay, they would usually come to work together. Huge Einstein. He was quite a tall man and very small girl, looking like Mutton Jeff.
Did you go? I mean, to seminars, presentations at the Institute. So Einstein would be in the audience as well. Did he ever comment and so on? And did you ever give a presentation?
Well, what happened? Einstein and I never interacted. As I said, I didn't approach him, although I could have.
I seem to remember some story about Feynman making a presentation.
I have nothing. Know nothing about Feynman.
Yeah.
But what happened was that I didn't finish my dissertation in time.
Which was on?
Oh, it was on a problem in nuclear physics, which we could discuss later if you like. But I didn't finish it on time, and I was delaying and putting it off and reading the Tibetan Book of the Dead in the Evans-Wentz translation. Anything just to avoid finishing the dissertation. So I wasted 6 months or so from the summer of 1950 to early January 51. But finally, the very early, first few days of January 1951, I did write the dissertation, turned it in, got the degree, all in a few days. And then I left for Princeton. They had saved the job for me at the Institute for Advanced Study in Princeton. So I left for Princeton sometime in January. And when I got there, my colleagues in physics were all discussing Einstein's last seminar, which was on his stab at a unified theory. As you know, he didn't really unify all of fundamental physics, just electricity and just electromagnetism and gravitation. He didn't include all the other things. And also he didn't have electrons as such. He hoped they would come out somehow. Just the theory of gravitation and electromagnetism. And it was not a correct theory anyway. But it was his stab at realizing his brilliant conjecture that there would be a universal theory, unified theory. The theory was published in 1949 in the Reviews of Modern Physics. And I had looked at it and knew about it and didn't have much confidence in it. Although the idea of a unified theory was, as I said, a brilliant idea. And we're still excited about it. But we would try to unify everything, whereas what Einstein did was just to try to unify gravitation and electromagnetism and hope that everything else would come out somehow. But he gave a seminar on it. I think it was his last Institute for Advanced Study seminar. This was in December 1950, so I just missed it by a month. But what happened was that my friends in the theoretical physics group were unable to concentrate on the lecture and its contents because of the way Einstein was dressed. He, at that time in his life, his second wife had died, as you know, and there was nobody really taking care of him very much. He wore sneakers, usually without socks, and baggy, unpressed trousers, and a sweatshirt, something like that. Over that, he would have a very nice black overcoat and a black hat, black sheepskin hat. Something of that kind. But the garments underneath were very rudimentary. Very rudimentary. However, on this occasion, there was an additional feature, namely that his fly was open and that his sweatshirt was protruding obscenely through the opening. And that's all anybody could remember. They couldn't remember what he said. But he was a very, very, very great man. We should not use this kind of thing to belittle him.
No. But you mentioned there, interestingly, the reading the Book of the Dead, anything to put off, yes. actually facing a blank page.
Yes.
Somebody once said to me that perfectionism leads to procrastination,
yes.
leads to paralysis.
Yes, that's right. That's exactly right.
Do you suffer from that?
Yes, terribly. Terribly. Terribly.
So I mean, Quark and the Jaguar, although finally finished...
I can't imagine how I finished it. In fact, I didn't really finish it. They sent a posse of armed men to seize the manuscript finally, publish it.
I mean, that story is recorded.
Or something like that.
So this was not a strange one-off thing that happened with this book, then?
No.
This is
it goes back to early childhood.
This is a Gale Mannery.
Well, I think it must be associated with my father, who was a critic, perfectionist critic. And I must have picked up that perfectionism somehow from him.
Hard to commit. This is a book called Advice to a Young Scientist that Peter Medawar wrote. Mm-hmm. You were probably called on to give advice to young scientists as you go along. Do you have any suggestions that you have for them about how to conduct themselves in their life as a scientist?
I don't think I have anything special to say. Obviously, one should follow curiosity. That's the main thing. Curiosity-driven science seems to be a very successful enterprise.
Can you imagine if you had not become a scientist, is there something else you would have done?
Well, it depends what you mean by scientist. All the things I wanted to be at different times could be considered to be within science. I was passionate about archaeology.
Right, but you also
passionate about linguistics.
Bird song. You study bird song.
Passionate about birds. Passionate about natural history in general. And so on. But all of these were scientific pursuits. I wanted to be an explorer, and in connection with archaeology, or in connection with natural history, or in connection with some other scientific undertaking. But yes, everything I wanted to be was like that. With one exception, there was a very, very, very brief period when I thought of a career as a musician, as a pianist. But it was clear to me after a little while that I didn't have the necessary. I don't know what to say. The necessary talent, I guess. I could play. I could learn how to play the notes and so on, but I would never be a great musician. It was clear.
It's amazing how many people, when I ask that question, scientists, many of them in fact offer being a musician as an alternative possibility. They're deeply interested in.
Well, sometimes it's a real possibility. With Heisenberg, for example, he was apparently very good, and had to choose, really, between being a concert pianist and being a scientist. But in my case, nothing like that would ever possibly have happened. It was a very brief period when I was a small child that I thought of going into music.
Yeah, Jerry Edelman was a very good violinist as well.
Is that so right?
Yeah.
Had
to choose.
There's a marvelous Dirac story, by the way, connected with Heisenberg and the piano. Do you know the story? It's not my story. I mean, it's one I heard from various people that he, after Heisenberg wrote his famous papers on quantum mechanics and Dirac chimed in with his work on quantum mechanics, they toured Europe together, giving lectures on the new quantum theory. And at each place, Heisenberg would be invited to play the piano at an evening gathering. And at one such, and Dirac would be there, of course, because they were both invited. And at one such gathering, they asked Heisenberg to play. And Heisenberg said, "Paul Adrian, you've been to so many of these things, and you've heard me play different pieces. What would you like me to play?" And Dirac said, "Oh, Werner, please play the one where you cross your hands." There's nobody like him.
Sound of the cat in the background must be Schrödinger's cat.
Let's not talk about Schrödinger's cat. God, it's awful.
Yeah, we have a cat outside, I think so.
No, I mean, Schrödinger's cat, if you say that a quantum event can be magnified in effect so as to lead to some macroscopic effect like the death or life of a cat, that's fine, that's true. It could have been something bigger. It could have been setting off a hydrogen bomb and destroying a whole city instead of just gassing a cat. But the idea is correct. But the rest of it is nonsense. This idea of the wave function being 1 over the square root of 2 times live cat plus dead cat is absurd. Because the cat is in interaction with the environment. It's not an isolated thing. It's just part of the environment with a history and part of the history of the universe. And that's the way to look at it. It's not an isolated thing, and therefore you don't have a sum of live cat plus dead cat. You have an entanglement with the whole rest of the universe.
Could you explain this many histories view?
Well, that's what quantum mechanics does. What quantum mechanics really does, given the initial state of the universe and given the laws of the elementary particles, quantum mechanics predicts the probabilities of alternative, coarse-grained, decoherent histories of the universe. Decoherent meaning the coarse-graining is such as to average out the cross-terms, average out the interference terms.
That's a seminar being announced.